market, the S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that, well, isn't too hungover. At least, I hope not. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, and for the first time in 2020, is Dr. Anirban Mahati. G'day, Doc. How are you, mate?
I am great, mate. How are you?
Happy New Year. And to you. Thank you, mate. And Happy New Year to all of our listeners as well. Now, this is going up, hopefully, if the good Lord is willing and the creeks don't rise, on the 3rd of January, our first podcast for the new year, 2020. Turns out we're actually recording this in 2019. So we're hoping that, well, frankly, we're hoping that the podcast is still a thing this year. We're hoping that people are still listening. We're hoping that nothing's gone wrong with the scheduling of the podcast. Assuming all that's true, you're listening to this on the same day as the first ball of the test in Sydney. So hopefully our boys are doing us proud on the field. And hopefully you're going to enjoy this podcast while you watch. Because, you know, quickest one of those things. You can watch on the TV with the sound muted. Just turn up if Nathan Lyon takes a wicket. Otherwise, stick with us and we will help you. In this particular case, Doc, we've got a short agenda. It's an important agenda. We've only got two items, mate.
How can we have short agenda?
We've only got two items on it.
We never have short agenda.
No, we do. We've never had just two items before. The first one is we're going to unveil our five stocks for 2020 and beyond. That's right, five stocks each, a total of 10 companies. We're going to put our stamp of approval on. We are going to make it happen. And then, because we love to, we're going to dip for the first time again this year, lots of firsts, mate, into the Foolish Mailbag. Let's get into it.
Let's do it.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, mate. Now, we're having I'm going to give you a little bit of leg room here, a little bit of room to move. We weren't going to talk about our successes or otherwise for the 2019 portfolio that we chose in early 2019, partly because we are recording this a few weeks before it goes to air. And so, frankly, goodness knows what's going to happen to the prices between then and now. We will check in on this list. Now, did we say 5-year or 3-year list? I can't remember.
I think we said 3. But I forgot. But we could do 3 or 5.
It was a long-term list. So 1 year is not going to make or break any of the positions nor any of the overall returns. I say that because I genuinely believe it. Also because somehow Doc is currently winning, and we don't like that. So I'm going to reinforce the fact this is a long term story. However, mate, I will let you take a very short, why would I say victory lap? But you know, you can have a bit of time in the sun. So bearing in mind this is in mid December, we will come back to this list properly, and we'll do a full debrief a little bit later, mate. But just for now, give us some headlines as to how our 2019 portfolio is going.
So, you know, here's the thing. Instead of taking a victory lap or anything, I think I'll just say this. If anyone followed the 10 picks that we suggested, they would be, on average,
yes,
miles ahead of the market, which is always a good problem to have.
Exactly. In fact, if I look at the numbers now, this is me in real time doing a quick bit of maths because, you know, I'm messing this up entirely. Hang on. I'm literally typing some formulas into Excel because that's what we do around here because we're numbers wonks. The average, as we speak, is 37.5%. No higher, 38.5%.
Here's a couple of other quick stats.
Go on.
Of the five stocks. Here's the other interesting thing. There was one company that both of us picked. Yes. Now the question is who stole whose idea is we haven't resolved that yet.
Well, it depends. If it keeps going well, I'll take credit, mate. If it falls from here, it's all your fault.
But the one company that both of us picked actually is the best performer across the lot.
Right, I see.
So that's interesting. again, it's only 1 year.
Yeah.
The other thing I'll point out is across the both of us, we've got only one stock that's actually two.
One each.
That's negative.
Now,
actually surprised by that.
We will properly review 2019 later. It has been a spectacularly good year for the market in general. And so our performance is good. I argue very good. Certainly market beating, at least thus far. We'll see what happens in a couple of weeks' time. But also it's been a fantastic year for the market. We did the numbers a little while ago, mate, but the market's up somewhere around 30% from its lows around this time last year. And about 25-ish% up for the year. So, you know, a really, really strong year so far, more than double the usual average for the year and about triple the average if you take the last 12 months rolling. It's been a very, very good year for the share market.
At this point, I should, you know, I'll remind people that, you know, often you'll hear this call, the clarion call of sell everything and run away.
Right.
When you sell everything and run away, this is what you miss, basically.
And, well, again, a massive tangent, but let's go with it. That was exactly what was being talked about in November, December. The tech stocks were on the nose. The market was down. People were wondering what the hell comes next. Like, it was a real, you know, it wasn't nothing, right? Like, this was genuinely, oh, here's the crash. It's finally here. I hope you're not invested. I hope you're in cash. It was a terrible, terrible piece of advice to take. And interestingly enough too, mate, worth saying, this has been a reasonably ordinary day for ordinary year, which is not a day, ordinary year economically. And so those who say the economy is up, therefore stocks are going up, or the economy is down, therefore stocks are down, or the economy is flat, therefore, there is, never has been, a direct correlation between GDP and share market returns. It just doesn't happen that way. Yeah. And so it's just a reminder that I saw what Greg McKenna, who's a guy I follow on Twitter, who's actually good on macro stuff, was saying something, I can't remember the exact phrase, but something like, and he's a trader, so, you know, we're not traders, we're investors, but I like Greg. He says something like, you need to separate the rhetorical self from the trading self. And maybe we should probably say the investing self from the trading self in this instance. The idea basically is, even if you think the economy is X, Y, or Z, investing accordingly is probably not the smartest thing to do.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Shall we move on to the stocks?
Let's move on.
All right. Now, should we do one each or should we go through a list each? What do you reckon?
You go through your list first.
Your whole list?
Yeah.
Okay.
Why not?
All right. So what we're going to do, we're making this up on the spot, mate. I'm literally thinking as I talk. So what we're going to do, we're going to go through the stocks. We're going to talk about the companies. And then I want you to ask me one pointed and challenging question for each company. Mm-hmm. And I'll do the same for you. And we'll try not to be negative, just to flesh out the thesis. If there's anything you think I missed or any particular challenges I haven't hit, make sure you call it out so we can make sure we tell our listeners. Now, as always, these are long-term investments. As always, we never would recommend anybody have just a portfolio of 5 stocks. And as always, we don't know what's going to happen in the next 3, 6, 9, or 12 months to these companies. So bear this up with a grunt. This is not the only buy list you should have. This is not the, you know, in any sense, the only companies you want to own or any guarantee that is necessarily going to do spectacularly well at all, let alone in the short term. So let me just put that out really, really clearly so we don't mislead or mistake anyone. First one on my list, mate. Now, I've said before, very publicly, including this podcast, I think ethical investing, as practiced by many people, is useless at best and actually potentially returns damaging at worst, because I don't know that where we invest our money in the secondary market, that is buying shares of other people, don't matter exactly to the companies we invest in. However, the first company on my list is a fund manager called Australian Ethical. They invest ethically. And some people might say, well, hang on, Scott, didn't you just say that it wasn't worth doing? Yeah, absolutely. The difference is I don't think, unfortunately for me, people should always listen to me, Doc, as you well know. But however, I don't think everyone's going to listen to me. And I think there's going to be plenty, plenty, plenty of people who chase down ethical investing options, no matter how misled I think they are. And I think Australian Ethical is likely to benefit from that. Now, Australian Ethical is a relatively small company. It is very exposed to the share market. So where the share market goes, so will go Australian Ethical. And if we have a decent market slump at some point, we will at some point, but if we haven't anytime soon, Australian Ethical will absolutely get tarred with that brush. As share prices fall, the amount of funds under management for Australian Ethical will fall. And as a business that makes its money based on a proportion of the funds it invests, it'll actually make less money in that sort of environment. Plus, if the market falls, it may not earn its performance fees either. So this is a business that will have lean years from time to time. Completely okay with that. Not worried in the slightest, but it will happen. It's a $400-odd million company. The current share price as we record this is about $3.67. The broad idea here is fund managers will make money from higher markets. I expect markets to go higher over time. That's the base. The second component is they seem to thus far have a good track record of investing well. That's important. And thirdly, the amount of money chasing ethical investments are going to rise over time. It's a very small company. It is the only, well, it's not the only, it's the dominant choice. If you whack Australian Ethical into Google, ethical investing into Google, you will find Australian Ethical, the company. And that's a really, really powerful thing. So there will be more competition. There'll be a heap more competition in 2, 3, and 5 years' time. Every fund manager seems to have an ethical option right now, and that's fine. But if you're looking to invest either your own money or increasingly your super, Australian Ethical is the place you are likely to come out. And I think over time, a relatively small business like Australian Ethical with $400 million of market cap, I think can be much, much, much bigger in look, you know, there's no guarantees about anything, but I think the chances are it's a lot bigger in the years to come. Doc, question, comment, challenge?
No, I don't have a challenge. I think, I guess the main challenge here would be, so the base assumption here is that the funds under management is going to increase over time.
Mm-hmm.
And they're basically going to do the charge a performance fee. I'm guessing the charge a performance fee as well,
mm-hmm.
right? So would you be worried if there's a lot more competition than that the amount one could charge for funds under management effectively goes down? So management fee probably in a competition is going to come down. How does that impact?
Yeah, really good question. So from my mind, my assumption is, and I could be wrong about any of these assumptions, by the way, my assumption is that superannuation and personal investing funds invested ethically, i.e. with an ethical filter as your starting point, are likely to be firstly more sticky. In other words, people are less likely to change away from Australian Ethical back to Perpetual or Platinum or Magellan or something, away from an ethical option back to a less ethical, just non-ethical option. Secondly, I think, again, if you're investing ethically, you are kind of intrinsically, some people are saying, I want to invest ethically and beat the market, and they will demand both. A decent proportion of people, I've spoken to friends and contacts, acquaintances, who've said, I just want to find ethical options. Those people, I think, are also going to be less price sensitive. I expect over time that, yes, there will be compression on fees, absolutely. You're mad if you don't think fees are going to be lower in 10 years than they are today. But I think the fund flows, plus the less price competitive, price focused nature of these particular fund investors, and the likelihood of them hanging around longer on average than the average fund investor, I think all go well for Australian Ethical.
Sounds good to me.
I'm going to talk about my second company, mate. And this second company, I don't know if you've heard of. It's a little business based in a little place called Omaha, Nebraska.
Never heard of it.
No, I wouldn't have thought so.
No.
Look, it's an old textile mill business run by an 80-something-year-old bloke.
90.
No, not yet.
Well, nearly 90.
Nearly 90. Not yet. He was born in 1930. His name, of course, is Warren Buffett, and he runs the investment conglomerate known as Berkshire Hathaway. This is not going to shoot the lights out. This is absolutely not going to be the company that tops the list, unless we have a massive market crash next year, in which case it actually may top the list, but probably be the least worst loser rather than the biggest winner. Berkshire Hathaway, for me, it's a cornerstone investment in my portfolio. If you're choosing any five stocks to build a portfolio around, I think you're mad if you don't have Berkshire as part of it. If it does nothing better than an index over time, then you're getting an index style investment option. If it does better than that, even better. Run by the smartest blokes in the room. Two of the new investment managers are pretty good. Both a combination of an investment portfolio and some wholly owned businesses that are generating good returns, and I think will for a very, very long time. This is not going to be your market smashing year by year investment. But I think it's market beating over the long term, certainly over 10 years or more. Now, mate, I don't know anything else about Berkshire Hathaway, so you probably got lots of questions. Any particular questions or challenges about Berkshire Hathaway?
So my question is relatively simple. Why not just have, instead of Berkshire, which could actually lose to market, it's probably lost to market over the last decade. It's actually lost to market. Last time I checked, it had lost to market by a small margin. Mm-hmm. Largely, I think, because of the cash drag it has got.
Yep.
Why not just buy an S&P 500 ETF?
Really good question, mate. In all honesty, in 10 years' time, we might look back and go, yeah, should have. So I'm absolutely leaving that open as a possibility. My contention, unless this is... So there's the old thing about the new normal, right? So what is genuinely a new normal, and what's just people thinking there's a new normal and it goes back to the old normal pretty quickly? My view is that I think Berkshire has struggled to beat the market over the last 10 years because, now, there's two things. One is tech is absolutely taking over, and that Berkshire is famously not a tech investment business. The second is that investors are paying up for growth companies. Now, we know, and I'm not going to draw a direct parallel, so stay with me till the end of this conversation. We know during the 98, 99, 2000 kind of tech boom and then bust, that Berkshire looked terrible for a few years and then looked great after that, because once the heat had gone out of some overpriced tech, Berkshire was kind of left having done the slow and steady thing and eventually winning the race. If and when there is less growth kind of, there are less gains by the growth part of the market, I won't say value necessarily, because Buffett's not traditional Graham value, but the idea of Berkshire being more likely, you know, we're talking about rotations in and out of stocks, right? I think it's fair to say there's not a lot of money going into the less growthy parts of the economy or parts of the market, I should say, and more money going into the growthy parts. And that has an impact on prices of both sets of companies. And that's exactly what happened to Berkshire. Berkshire fell meaningfully during 98, 99, and then, of course, held and then rose after that while others crashed about it. Now, I don't think there's going to be a tech crash. It's not a direct analogy. But I do think over time, if and when the stellar, astonishing, wonderful gains, including some of the companies I own, by the way, of the tech businesses settles down, quietens down, I think Berkshire may well come into its own. And if that is the case, that the biggest and brightest and best of the Microsoft, Facebook, Apple, Google, Amazon, et cetera, Netflix, don't deliver the same sorts of gains in the future they have in the past, it may well be the case that Berkshire, that rebalance helps Berkshire beat the market. And that's my supposition.
All right.
Next one is another business I own. It's Corporate Travel Management. It's also one that was in last year's portfolio. By the way, I will go through the ticker codes at the end of this. Corporate Travel Management is a business that helps corporate travelers, funnily enough, or companies, organize travel on behalf of their teams. It's in a really interesting part of the business. Its core proposition, by the way, is you pay it a fee and you still end up paying less for travel than you would have if you didn't use it at all. The combination of reporting, so staff, you don't have to have the boss's PA organizing your travel, the travel authorizations and approvals are done automatically, the customer service is provided directly by these guys, who's basically an online travel agent of sorts. That's effectively what they are, really. They're an online travel agent, but for corporates. And the experience time and time and time again is by the time you use Corporate Travel Solution, not only do you spend less money on admin and with better reporting, you actually spend less money on travel overall, even though you're paying Corporate Travel a fee. Now you say, how is that possible? And the answer is because the bookings and the process, the management of the system ends up being a better deal even after paying their fee than it was before doing it. It seems counterproductive, counterintuitive. It's not, it ends up being true for most, if not all, of the clients they work with. Their customer retention is fantastic. Their international growth has been strong. They've been bashed up by shorters. Now, this time last year, the share was actually higher. So this is the one stock Doc mentioned that is actually losing in my set of five from 2019. But here in 2020, if anything, I think the shares have come down so much and the business continues to grow organically and lesser by acquisition. That organic growth, if it continues, I think will continue to look after shareholders. It is my largest ASX holding. And so it's on some levels only right that I put it forward. But I think Corporate Travel Management is one of the less appreciated businesses. I think the short case thus far has been unproven. And I think the simple underlying growth of this business continues to impress. And I think it will be a long-term outperformer.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
What say you, Doc?
I guess my main question with corporate travel would be growth has come a lot partly via acquisitions and partly organically.
Correct.
Now, when corporate travel was small, acquisitions had a meaningful impact in terms of driving growth because, if you're making $100 million and you can bring in another, $20 million, that's a 20% bump.
Right.
But now if you're doing $1 billion and you can bring in only $20 million, it's not that much of a bump. So as you become larger, growth by acquisition becomes harder. That's one.
Yep.
I guess related to that is the other, corporate travel, like many ASX companies, has used quantitative easing in some form, which is basically print their shares to buy companies.
Yep.
now that works well when your share price is high.
Mm-hmm.
But with the shorters beating down the share price, it makes it harder for them to acquire a meaningfully sized acquisition to drive earnings growth.
Yep. Or you need to pay significantly more for it in total consideration. Rather than giving them 15 shares, you got to give them 25 shares instead for the same dollar value. So it
causes dilution, and therefore the EPS growth is not as accretive as it could be.
Correct. Spot on.
So how do you think about these things?
Yeah, really good. So look, the PE currently is about 22 times earnings. That's not cheap, but it's not super expensive. For business that grew organic earnings, I should say, about, I want to say high teens, if I remember rightly, last earnings period. And that was without any meaningful acquisitions. So my general thought is that it absolutely will make acquisitions less likely and or more expensive and or more dilutive. That's absolutely true. I'm not super concerned, frankly, about its I'm not super concerned about the acquisition part of its business, particularly because the price has come down. Now, if this was still a $30 stock, I'd be saying, well, man, they've got to do something to justify this lofty PE. But with a PE of 22 and with decent organic growth, I think any acquisitions it manages to do will be kind of the icing on the cake. And frankly, it also helps get the shorters off their back. The longer they go without making another acquisition, the less the shorters can claim there is something dodgy going on with the accounting for organic sales growth. So you are dead right. It will be more expensive and or harder outright to do acquisitions. There may be less acquisition candidates. And as you've already mentioned, having to buy a larger chunk of business each time to deliver the same percentage growth, I'm actually pretty happy that they've pivoted partly because they wanted to, partly because they had to, into pure organic growth. They've built out a network in Asia, in Europe, in the UK, and in the US. Not necessarily in that order. In fact, probably almost entirely in the reverse order. But at some point, they can now either bolt on little bits or start to just organically grow out that network, particularly in the States, by the way, but just in general. And I think it's got many years of decent, not spectacular, but decent growth ahead of it. Compounded, that's an impressive number, organically. And if they make some well-timed or well-chosen or well-priced acquisitions, that's even better.
Sounds good to me.
Mate, my next one, my fourth, my penultimate idea is again one that was in the list last year. Now, I'm happy to say this one's up. But as we talk about, you know, sometimes you want to pay a higher price for a great company. This business is basically, you and I have slightly different views on this, I think. So I'm going to give you mine and you can, in your challenge, feel free to disagree. I'm a big believer in long-term tailwinds for Australian growth through exposure to China. Now, everyone say, yeah, we know that. But normally people think about iron ore, or they think about coal, or they think about something else. In this case, I think Australian consumer brands have a really, really strong tailwind going into China. The Chinese consumer, obviously the Chinese population is massive. The Chinese consumer is rapidly becoming more affluent on average. Again, not every Chinese person, but the average Chinese consumer. And the Western brands are status symbols are and will remain, I think will grow as status symbols for Chinese consumption. So I came from a couple of jobs ago from an alcohol company that had done spectacularly well, selling very, very high-priced whiskey into Asia in general, China and Japan in particular. We're seeing that Chinese consumers have a strong demand for Australian brands across the board. Now, there are hits and misses. We've talked about Bellamy's challenges in the past. We've also talked about A2 successes. And while New Zealand might claim A2, we're going to do the Russell Crowe Pavlova Farlap thing and claim that as Australia. But the idea of kind of, you know, brand Australia, it's not a panacea. You can't just put Australia or anything and sell it into China. But the growth of wine and premium wine in particular, both in volume and price terms into Asia and China again in particular, makes me think that Treasury Wine Estates remains a really great business to get long-term exposure to the Chinese consumer. They have fantastic pricing power. They're exercising that pricing power like you would not believe. And the reality is that if you have to make and then store wine, it's pretty... there's not too much cost differential between making and storing Grange or making and storing a bottle of Queen Adelaide, right? Now, the difference between those is you can sell one for a much, much higher price. If Treasury can, I think they will, continue to get higher and higher prices per litre of wine sold and the cost don't accelerate at the same rate, you've got volume growth, you've got price growth, and I think you've got margin expansion over time. Now, Treasury is not just an Australian winemaker. I should say, by the way, the brands in Australia are the Penfolds, Wynns, I think Lindemans. The brands, they sell a whole lot of American wine, also has a little bit of French wine. So there's also a global play more broadly, and that's still a positive thing. They're quality brands around the world. That's the kind of the big picture story. But the really attractive growth part of the story in my mind is the growth of Australian wines into China, particularly high value and high prestige brands. And Penfolds Grange is obviously top of that list, but there's plenty that are in that order. And that's why I think Treasury is a long-term outperformer.
You know, on this one, I don't really have any key question. My main issue here might be that Treasury has some debt on its balance sheet, right? Mm-hmm. How do you think about a company like this, which has got some debt on its balance sheet, and how do you think it might, if there's a meaningful, say, for example, a Chinese slowdown, how effective would a company like Treasury be?
That's a really good question. The debt is, because look, the challenge with any business that's in the wine business, particularly Treasury, is you have a decent amount of inventory that sits on the shelf for a decent amount of time. And the more expensive the wine is, the longer it has to sit around. Now, you're eventually made good on that because X years out, you get to sell it for multiples of the cost of production. Now, I don't know how much it costs to produce a bottle of Grange, but I'm tipping it's in the tens of dollars. Maybe it's, I don't know, 10, 20, 30, 40 bucks. I don't really know. You're selling it for $500, $600, $700, $800. The margins are phenomenally large. The only challenge is you've got to wait a little while to get that money back. So they don't own many of the wineries. They own some wineries. Vineyards. They own some, but not many. They own wineries and they own effectively storage facilities and they own sell the product. They have to carry some degree of working capital in just pure inventory, and the inventory turnover is phenomenally low compared to someone like a Woolies that turns over its inventory every 14 days. Treasury's averaged inventory turnover, and I've never done the numbers, but it's probably more than a year. It's possibly more than 2 years, particularly if you do it by dollar value, because grain sits on the shelf for years and years and years at a time. So I think that's an important consideration. The bigger issue, I think, is probably the risk of the inventory they're using that capital to pay for. So to be really clear, debt is absolutely always a risk, because there's always a chance that whatever you've used that debt for isn't worth the debt you've taken on to do it. In this case, if the wine was turned out terrible, if they'd have a bad vintage year and had to cut the prices of the wine, there are absolutely areas of times where there could be problems. They've also done some acquisitions, some other things in the past. So this is a complex business. It also is trying to get a whole lot of supply chain costs out at the same time. I don't expect the debt to be a problem in terms of the ability for the company to continue to operate and earn market-beating returns, but it's absolutely an additional layer of risk that investors need to be mindful of. Now, you know, businesses like Sydney Airport and Transurban are basically, you know, debt vehicles with airports or roads attached, and they're decent quality businesses because of their business models. There's no way in the world Treasury is as high quality in terms of recurring revenue flows as a toll road or an airport, but I do expect the debt not to be a problem for the company. Shall I hit my last one?
Go for it.
All right. And then we'll go back through the tickers. The last one is a US-listed company, the only US-listed company or investment, I should say, and I'll explain why, on my list of five. And again, it's one that came from last year. It remains one of what I think should be a cornerstone position for almost any investor, any Australian investor, and that is the NASDAQ, the BetaShares NASDAQ ETF. We talk about it all the time. Basically, if you want to invest in some of the best and highest growth businesses in the world, they are found on the US exchanges. You can open a US brokerage account. We would strongly suggest you do that. Get invested directly. That's a wonderful thing to do. But if you're not going to, or you're not ready to, or simply you'd rather not, the BetaShares NASDAQ ETF is an ASX-listed instrument that gives you exposure, market cap-weighted exposure, to all of the NASDAQ 100 except for the financials. Basically, it's a tech ETF, very low cost, very index-friendly. Not as low cost as some of the absolute vanilla ETFs like the Vanguard stuff, but there is no Vanguard NASDAQ ETF, at least as far as I know. The BetaShares one is a really great way to get exposure to all of the tech names you already know and you're already thinking about, plus the ones of tomorrow, the ones that aren't yet the big and the best and the greatest. It's a challenge to really understand exactly how we, you know, can get... You could invest in the US, as I said, and I think you should. But if you're not going to, NASDAQ ETF should be in everyone's portfolio. It's in mine. It's in my sister's. I just think unless you want income, the NASDAQ ETF is something you really, really should have as part of your portfolio. And that's my fifth and final. Now, Doc, I'm going to give away a little bit of behind the curtain here. I'm just going to say out loud, because we're doing this in one take, you actually have one company there twice on your list. I've just had a quick cheat. So I'm going to talk for a minute while I let you try and work out how to replace that fifth company with something else, just to avoid us having an awkward exchange in a few minutes' time. So I'm going to run through my list of companies while Doc thinks desperately for a better idea. The top five companies for 2020 and beyond. And remember, this is not just for 12 months at all. Please don't mishear that. And if you are listening now, I know you haven't misheard it because I've said it really clearly. The five companies on my list are Australian Ethical. The code is AEF. The second company, actually, I said there's only one US company. There's actually two. There was Berkshire as well. I should have known that. The second one for me was Berkshire Hathaway. The code is New York Stock Exchange, BRK.B or -B, depending on your broker. There is A-class shares, which are $300,000 odd. The B-class shares are $220, so go with that. The next one is Corporate Travel Management, ASX CTD, not CTM, CTD, Corporate Travel Management. Treasury Wine Estates, or TWE, the company acronym, which is always nice and easy. And the last one is the BetaShares NASDAQ ETF, or NDQ. Right, that's my five.
I had a question about the NDQ.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
I wouldn't have thought you would, but go for it.
Okay. Here's a question.
Go on.
NDQ has got two companies which are over $1 trillion in market cap US.
Yep.
Two trying to become $1 trillion in market cap US.
Yeah.
One nearly a half or two nearly half a trillion dollar companies.
Yep.
How does this thing continue to outperform in the years ahead?
Nice. So there's oh man, you want me to short answer that shortly?
Short answer.
Oh man, okay. So very quickly, first is outperform in this case is versus the ASX or the All Ords that we use as our benchmark. So in terms of outperforming, it can simply outperform by doing better than the ASX. That's the first thing. Not that I'm expecting the ASX to do terribly, by the way, but it's just a relative thing in absolute. Can I say a relative thing in absolute terms? Probably not. That's probably an oxymoron. But it's a relative performance question. Second is the great thing about an ETF is you don't have to know which companies of those 100 are going to do well or badly. You just have to believe that overall there's going to be value created across the board. Now, a couple of those $1 trillion companies will probably go on to become $2 trillion companies in 10 years. Others that we aren't talking about yet will become the big winners of tomorrow. And I have a feeling you might take us through some of those big winners of tomorrow when we talk through your list, Doc. So, it's unreasonable to expect the top five will be the top five with each individually market-beating performance. Hopefully some will, some won't. Overall, though, the great thing about ETF is it changes weightings for you as it grows. So if a company doubles in size, it ends up with twice the weighting in that ETF, which is a wonderful way to basically get automatic rebalancing. And I think over time, I'm not really a macro thematic kind of guy, but I just think, I've said before lots of times, it feels like a marketing cliche. These are literally the companies who are inventing the future. And I can't imagine a scenario where that group as a whole aren't market beating it. Unless they literally stop inventing the future, unless something dramatically changes, to imagine that the rest of the world's companies end up growing faster than the best tech companies on the planet, I think it's just a remarkably difficult thing to imagine. And that's behind my confidence.
How'd cool. I go? That was great.
All right, mate, you're in the hot seat. Let's change seats. Let's virtually get up, metaphorically walk across the table, sit down the other chairs. All right, that's done. Man, I'll tell you what. Theater of the mind, people. Theater of the mind. Stay with us.
Value stocks.
Market. Stock market.
Index. Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, buddy. Let us hear your top five stocks for 2020 and beyond.
All right. Okay, I'm going to do... My list is interesting. I've got two ASX-listed stocks and three... U.S. listed companies.
Okay,
but here's the interesting thing. The two ASX listed stocks actually happen to be from New Zealand.
And why do you hate Australia, Doc?
This is funny.
I'm telling ScoMo.
I was just... You should tell ScoMo. he needs to do something about the entrepreneurial characteristics of Australia. I was just thinking this is funny because there's two Kiwi companies on the list. There are two American companies on the list and there's a Brazilian company on the list. So... Let's get started. So the first one on my list is a company called Serco. The code is SKO.
Okay.
And what this company does basically is provide software to travel companies like Corporate Travel or Flight Center or others. And what it effectively does is it provides software that can be used to automate booking, to connect hotels and so on. And so it's basically the plumbing behind corporate travel companies or corporate travel management companies. And recently, as a proof of how effective their technology could potentially become, one of the world's largest travel agencies, it's basically over the top travel agency, basically is travel agency that operates on the internet, booking.com. Mm-hmm. Now people might not if you're not familiar with booking.com, then it's also called Priceline. It should be mm-hmm. called Priceline, but booking.com is probably some people might be familiar with book. It's one of the largest travel agencies in the world.
Fair to say though, it's probably not big in Australia, right? The Australian kind of travel booking market's been a little bit unusual. Booking.com as a brand is big. Priceline.com is big in the US.
Yeah.
They don't really have any massive properties here in Australia at the moment, but it's enormous overseas.
Yeah, yeah. So Booking.com is very popular in Europe. Priceline.com is very popular in the US. They're not massively popular here in Australia. So Serco is interesting because Serco basically provides 90% of the plumbing in the ANZ market. It's basically the dominant plumber for travel agencies in this side of the world. And they're basically trying to take the same idea, same tech, and essentially make it dominant in the Northern Hemisphere.
Right.
Now, they don't have to dominate the Northern Hemisphere, but if they can take a small, decent share, 5% even, that would be enough to effectively double, triple their current volume of work. And they could, you know, we've got some dominant travel companies here, like Flight Center has operations in the US, for example, and in Canada and so on. So, you know, that's one nice pathway to find a good foothold in North America. So, yeah, and it's not without risks. It's a small company, relatively small company. It's under, I would say, $400 million market cap off the top of my head. Yeah, so that's what I do.
Interesting. Why own the plumber and not the company with brand power like a Flight Center or a Corporate Traveler or a Booking Holdings? Is Serko at some risk of simply being, you know, the next and the last kind of provider of software in this area? Obviously, there's other competitors. What gives it the right ability, likelihood to remain dominant in this space?
Yes, that's a very, very interesting question. So one of the things I think is as the world sort of moves towards more software, I think one of the things that we see is, you know, if you are a travel agency, then your specialist, your specialization is travel agency. Stick with that. For the software that you need for it, don't try to develop it, use a specialist. So I think that's sort of the underlying idea there, is that, you know, stick with the specialists for the specialist jobs. And you know, the fact that they've had, they have about 80 to 90% of the market here in Australia and New Zealand is testament to the fact that, you know, they're providing quality solutions that other people are using. And these are, you know, Corporate Travels and the Flight Centers are dominant brands locally. So why is it not dominant overseas is, I guess, a related question. And that's because there's, SAP has had a solution called Concur, which has which is largely the dominant solution in North America and Europe. And that's what they are basically trying to replace. The idea here would be that they've got a more modern solution which they effectively can displace Concur. But they don't need to displace Concur from, you know, the number one position. They just need to make enough room for to be a decent number two.
Nice. What's next?
All right. The next one, this was there, I believe, last year as well. I changed up my list a bit just to create a little bit. I could have pretty much gone with my list last year.
Me too. It was hard to get extras, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I thought I'll add some, just for the sake of variety and some newness, although that's not necessarily a good idea in investing. Sometimes your best ideas are your existing ideas. This was already there last year. It's a company called MongoDB, which basically does effectively does database as a service. But its key offering is a database that is no longer a relational database, or no longer a database that is just a row column type of database, or key value pair with two row column structure. But really, what's it's a database called a NoSQL database. So basically, a database that, think of it, it's not a relational, it's basically not a relational database. And it's a database that allows for storing documents of different different sizes, or different number of columns and so on. So the key thing here is that they have got an offering called Atlas, which is a database as a service offering. It runs on the cloud. You basically sign up. Everything works from the cloud.
Right.
And, you know, you pay as you go based on how much you're using compute and storage. Right. And it works off all the cloud, major cloud players, Microsoft, Amazon, and Google, and, you know, even Alibaba, for example, in China. And the Atlas component has been growing really fast. It's about that component itself is a $175 million run rate business. Last quarter, it was growing at about 185% year over year. So even if that growth slows down, you know, a bit or some, it's still a phenomenally fast business. And that ramp up has happened over a couple of years, which goes to show how powerful that model could be. And it's a great funnel for growing the other enterprise side of their business, where they, you know, make bigger deals and, you know, longer term deals and so on. So, yeah, I really like this. It's a very disruptive company. And, yeah.
It's to use the vernacular, bloody expensive. How sure are you it's going to be justifying its current price in 5 years' time?
Let me say it's cheaper than Pro Medicus.
Everything's cheaper than Pro Medicus.
Yeah, you know, here's the best way to think about this is it's, you know, I'll give you a rough estimate. Mm. It's roughly doing, let's say it's going to do about $420 million by the end. It's reported third quarter. By the end of this year, it will do about $420 million of revenue.
Mm-hmm.
I expect it that this is a company that can grow at about 30 to 35% for quite some time, which means it can double every, you know, revenue should be roughly doubling every 2 years.
Okay.
That takes me, so, you know, take 420, call it 420, it's an easy number. You know, that basically means, you know, let's make it 450 for easy math. So that makes it 900 in 2 more years. And in 4 years, you're roughly at about 1.8 billion.
Mm.
Right. So if you think out a few years and you think the impact and the size of this business and the revenue it generates, remember, this is a highly scalable business. It's a software business. These sort of businesses can have, you know, EBITDA margins of, you know, 30% plus. How much would people pay for a $1.8 billion run rate business that is still growing at, say, 30%?
Mm.
You know, somewhere north of, I would say, 15 to 18 billion. You know, if you're paying 15 to 18 billion, that's really a, you know, nice double from here in 4 years. I'll take a nice double in 4 years.
That's good. What's next, mate?
The next one is, again, a company I had last year on my list. It's a small Kiwi company, but fortunately Australian only company. Listed in Australia, so we can call it an Australian company.
Definitely Australian company.
Definitely Australian
company. Some of Australasia's best.
Yeah, Australasia's best. And, you know, it's not our fault that New Zealand has a small market. We'll take their companies. So this is a company called Volpara Health Technologies. This basically is a software company, another software company, which provides software to breast cancer screening centers.
Mm-hmm.
And effectively, they provide software that does a bunch of different things, but it provides ability to automate you know, measurement for breast density, which is one of the known factors for breast cancer, and therefore it can be used for deciding or evaluating next steps in terms of who needs further screening.
Mm.
And it's also an enterprise, you know, management software in the sense that it also allows you to keep track of things like, you know, how well your radiographer is doing, how well is the machine being used, you know, how is the pressure, what type of pressure was applied when the breast, you know, mammogram was done, and so on. So it's a quality control software. It's got some nice tailwinds in the form of the FDA, which in the US, providing, requiring that the screening centers make sure that they, you know, they've been providing, they've been provided the density information, and that their, you know, technicians are actually doing the right thing in terms of, you know, how, you know, how they're actually going about doing the breast density measurements, so in terms of doing the mammograms. So this business is primarily U.S. focused in terms of its sales. But its opportunity is really global. And, you know, they've got about 8% of the market share roughly right now in the U.S. So there's a long, long runway, long opportunity here. And again, this is another expensive business by any traditional measure. But yeah, if it can become dominant and have a dominant share of the breast screening market, then, you know, I think this is a winner.
Very good. I'm curious as to the... I mean, obviously, it's ticking all the right boxes. What can bring Volpara undone? Is it simply a lack of traction? Is it a competitor? Is it overreach? Is it price? I mean, still a decent way to go to be traditionally, I won't say cheap, but fairly valued. A lot of kind of, you know, future built into the current share price. What keeps you up at night when it comes to Volpara?
So there are a couple of things. One, this company recently did a big transaction, which was an acquisition, but more or less like a merger. They acquired a patient information system company out of the U.S. And what that does is, this is one of the stumbling blocks in some sense. Patient information system basically stores patient information. And this company's patient information, MRS, had about 25% market share.
Right.
Effectively, for Volpara software solutions to work well, you really want it to integrate with patient information system. Then it becomes like one whole thing. So on the one hand, you can say that this is a good thing because it allows them to integrate MRS with Volpara. But the other hand, the other patient information system providers, the remaining 75%, they might not like this idea or the commission. They'll make it more resistant to... So on the one hand, there's cross-sell opportunities with MRS clients. The other hand, you might be actually be blocking opportunities. So that's something that I worry about. The other thing I really worry about is it's a small software company. It's still pretty subscale. And software companies can generate really high margins, but at scale. So the question really is, can you get to a decent enough scale where you are generating enough money? Because at some point you're going to be you're going to be evaluated, or you're going to be valued based on cash flows that you're generating, not based on multiples of your revenues and so on. Right. So this is a really
Is it scale or bust?
Yeah, I mean, if it doesn't scale, there is a problem, because I mean, this, you know, the it's annual revenue is probably around, you know, it's probably going to do about 25 million ish. Revenue in a year. That is not big, right? In a sort of a global context, when you're thinking of global markets, on the one hand, I was talking about MongoDB, that's doing 420 million and it still loses money, right? Here we are talking about 25 million TV dollars.
Scale is relative.
Right?
Yeah.
And you're losing money, right? Yeah, so, I mean, and it's an order of magnitude, you know, a factor of 20 difference. So, yeah, so I mean, that is the big risk.
Mate, the next one, you've mentioned to me before, because I recognize the name. I can't remember what it does. Tell me about it.
So the next one is interesting. You know, one company that you really like has actually staked it. The next company is called StoneCo. It's a weird name. It's a Brazilian company.
Now I remember.
Go on. What it does is basically, it's the easiest way to think about it is it's an FPOS solution provider. Now, that doesn't sound very interesting, does it? But in the Brazilian context, where you're serving, and it serves mostly small to medium scale enterprises, there are lots and lots of them in Brazil. But it does a bunch of other things. It provides software for managing your business. It provides CRM solutions for managing your business. It also provides... you know, in addition to providing the FPOS and the ability to actually, you know, transact, it also provides, in some sense, financing for running your business. So, you know, if you are being paid with some sort of credit instrument and you don't get paid immediately, they will provide you the money now so that you have the cash flow for running business. And, you know, in return for that, they take a cut. Right. So the interesting thing about this business is that it's a relatively... young business, but it's highly profitable, and you know it's got strong net margins. It's growing really at a fast rate, and it still has only about 6-7% of the market share in Brazil. And if it can get to its stated goal of 25% market share, which the market is dominated like our market by the FPOS provider of big slow incumbent almost dead banks. This will be a phenomenally profitable, profit-gushing machine. As I mentioned, Berkshire Hathaway has a cornerstone stake in this business. They've had it, I think, since IPO.
You're welcome.
Now, I don't think this is a Warren Buffett position. This is a position from via one of his lieutenant.
Yes, Ted or Todd.
Ted or Todd. One of those guys has been building positions in fintech businesses around the globe. And so this is a fintech business out of Brazil. They have some fintech positions in Australia, in India, and so on. But I think it's interesting that, you know, that they have it's not a big component of my thesis, but my component of the thesis is Brazil has a growing market. Its middle class is growing. It's, you know, in a middle, you know, it's a middle income country that's trying to grow. This is a profitable business, really growing fast, run by, you know, the founder still at the helm. It ticks a lot of boxes. It's rare to find, you know, fast-growing business yet that's profitable. And when I say fast-growing, it's like growing top line at 50, 60%, 70%, right?
Amazing.
So amazing. So, yeah, I really, really like this.
Mate, there's lots being said in the media and elsewhere about South American troubles, both economically, frankly, sometimes law and order, and also currency. If I'm thinking about a Brazilian company How am I thinking about it in terms of probably the US dollars it reports in, the Australian dollars I get from it? You know, what's the – are there risks there? Are there concerns there? You know, I guess in some scenario, the Brazilian real could be meaningfully lower permanently or something else. How are you thinking about currency?
I think you hit all my, you know, if I was writing a recommendation and I was going to say risks section, this is exactly what I would say. Absolutely. So Brazil is a country with a lot of promise, a lot of opportunities, a lot of smart people, huge corruption.
Right.
So overnight, rules of engagement could change.
Yeah.
That could destroy this business. There's also a lot of competition in Brazil, and the incumbents have engaged in price wars. These guys have not engaged in price wars and basically have stuck to essentially saying, well, you know, we offer a value-added solution and people will pay for that value-added solution. So far, it seems to be true. Brazilian economy has been under a recession for like God knows how long.
Yeah, right.
So, yes, I mean, this is, let me put it this way. I like this company. I really think this company is a good company to own. It provides opportunity in terms of, it provides access to an emerging market, provides access to a different type of market, yet while providing access to, you know, exposure to fintech growth. But yeah, I would be careful in terms of how much or how big a position like this should be in a portfolio. And yeah, all the risks you say, any one of them can come to pass.
Mate, you're 4/5 of the way there. Hit us with your last great stock for 2020 and beyond.
My last great stock, this was a stock I believe also on my 2019 list. Actually, it was not. How, what a big omission. Okay. This company is called Alteryx. The code is AYX. And it basically does data science for the non-data scientists. Mm. It provides a suite of software solutions that can be used for basically mining the data and understanding the data. This company has been growing at a really incredible pace. It's, you know, already cash flow positive, and you know, I can see this type of solution having widespread use in, you know, some of the world's largest companies, but not just the largest companies, even some of the large, not so large companies. And yeah, as they said, data is the new currency, and this company is at the forefront of mining that currency. So I think this company again has a bright future just from that point of view.
In terms of the tech landscape, how much, it's obviously on the forefront of change, how much runway, I mean, it's got all the runway in the world in absolute terms. In relative terms, you've talked a lot about tech leadership and amounts of kind of how far ahead of the competition companies are as to how much kind of tough free time they have. How confident are you that it stays at the forefront of the competitive set over time?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I mean, the many of these companies that I mentioned, they spend a huge amount of money on R&D. A good part of the reason they're not that profitable yet is that they are spending, you know, upwards of 20% of their revenue on R&D. So I think building scale and building R&D capabilities to stay in the forefront is important. The one thing I want to point out is, both with a company like MongoDB or with StoneCo or with Alteryx, what is important is how ingrained you become in the workflow of your customers.
To some degree, because these are structural, almost seismic changes in a lot of industries, right? Like once you take the service on, you're kind of fundamentally changing your workflow in a way you may not do again.
Exactly. So like if you're using MongoDB as an example, then you've re-architected your database to use MongoDB. Your applications are now using MongoDB as a database. This sort of change happens once in a generation.
Right.
Right. And the bet here would be that the pace of Atlas's growth basically shows that there is a huge generation of developers who are developing new applications around this.
Nice.
And they're not going to be changing it anytime soon. The same thing with the growth of Alteryx basically shows that there's all these businesses that are building workflows around Alteryx, and they're basically replacing, Excels and other archaic type of solutions. And it is hard to see how, you would shift from this to something else in a relatively short period of time, which gives these companies to, you know, the ability to continue to grow their, you know, their toolkit, but also to, you know, just becoming more and more ingrained and more incumbent. You know, again, this is sort of like, it's a play saying that, you know, these are once in a generation sort of changes. The same thing with Stone Co. You'd say that the changes happening in the Brazilian economy and the small and medium scale entrepreneurs and businesses are making this. I would say the same thing is also true for Volpara, in the sense that breast cancer clinics are being required to do this, right? And they're doing this now.
Right, right.
And once you do this, unless the standard of care changes, this becomes the standard of care.
Mm.
Right. And yeah, so at least for those software companies, I think that's the trend. To some extent, one could say the same thing for Serco too. Like, once you find yourself embedded, it's unlikely, you know, it takes money, time, energy to embed those solutions. There is a decent implementation phase of bringing your solution on board to an existing, you know, travel management company.
Right, right. Yeah.
Once you spend that time, energy, and got people in your travel management company to use these workflows, why would you change that soon unless, you know, there is an impending reason to do so?
Mate, that is a wonderful way actually to finish up, because that is the sort of thing that kind of typifies your investment approach. And frankly, I won't necessarily put words in your mouth and say all five of these stocks, but I think all five of these stocks. I mean, there's some degree of, you know, your style is to back the next generation of innovation, and you know, some will win, some will not necessarily win, but overall, that has been over time and continues to be, with your own investing, a really successful way to invest.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, it's, yeah, I was always mindful that, you know, we're we've been in a bull market, which means that, you know, all these sort of entrepreneurial things get priced up, and that helps.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, I find this approach useful. And as you said, I don't think, you know, all of these ideas would be winners. In fact, I expect on average, most of the things that I pick, I would think, I'd be very happy if I get 50% of them right. But I think that 50% mark is still probably sufficient, because I think that ones that win, they win really well.
Yeah.
And, you know, the upside is always more than the downside, because, you know, the maximum you lose is probably 100%. Mm. So.
I like it. By the way, my point wasn't that you have some losers at all. My point was more just the excitement of this particular approach is impressive. And certainly, I think, even as you're talking, I'm thinking, why am I doing more of this? So maybe I should consider more of it. I'll come to you with some ideas.
No. My point was to just mention that I have losers.
That's fair, mate.
It's to just remind myself and everybody else.
I like the honesty. Do you want me to run through the stocks, or do you want to run through the stocks?
The codes?
The stocks and the codes.
Okay. So the first one was Serco. The code is SKO. This is on the ASX. The next one was MongoDB. This is, I believe, a NASDAQ-listed company. It's a U.S. company. Code is MDB. The third one was a Kiwi company, which we're basically calling an Australian company, called Volpara Health Technologies. It's headquartered in Wellington, but they all, you know, who knows Wellington or Sydney. the code is VHT, ASX VHT. The next one was Stoneco. The code is STNE. This is a NASDAQ-listed company. And the last one was Alteryx, and the code is AYX.
Very good. Thank you, sir. We will cover these. We'll probably check in, and maybe once every 6 months, once every 12 months. We'll see how we go. It's a bit of fun for us, and hopefully it's a bit of interest for you. We do pick these stocks, and we think they're likely to be market-beating as a group. Again, I'll remember group. Don't pick one and then ask us why that one didn't work. I have no idea which, if any, or all are going to do best or worst or in between. So as always, consider this part of a portfolio. I have a speculation that all 10 would make a nice portfolio, actually. But separate to that, anyway, I have a think about that. And as a reminder, we are recording this early, so we will, we'll kind of lock in the price as we get closer. We'll also, probably in a couple of weeks' time, I think, Doc, maybe 2 or 3 weeks from now, we will look back on our 2019 stocks. And hopefully by then I will have caught up with you. Otherwise, I might just put off another couple of months and just delay the pay.
Just put off for another 6 months?
I have to. Now, mate, before we go, we've got a little bit of time, a little tiny bit of time. You know what I want to do, don't you?
Some questions.
Let's get into the mailbag. All right, let's do something akin to, we don't do exactly rapid fire. You and I have a lot to say on a lot of topics, but let's do what we can. The first question is from Adrian, mate, saying, "Hi, Captain and Doc. Love the podcast as always, and I'm not just saying that to try and get my question answered on the pod. Well, maybe. I love how you tell it how it is in regards to how the media creates sensationalist headlines and helping us fools stay calm. Adrian, if we're doing nothing other than that, I reckon our job's pretty well done. I'm really pleased, humbled that you've taken that from us. I say regularly, I will continue to say probably more than in the past, investing is as much and probably more a psychological exercise than it is an academic one. I think if you can get that bit right, you're miles ahead of most other people. And in investing, you don't need to be that much further ahead of other people to do very, very well over the long term. My question is how to get into a mindset of not looking back on the what ifs and regretful selling. I previously purchased Avita Medical a few years ago as an inexperienced 20-year-old and held it until a ripe old age of 23. Seriously, Doc, they're just trolling us.
This is just like rubbing it in.
I'm pretty sure they're trolling us now. Because I felt like management was not looking after shareholders and gifting themselves shares. After a tumultuous couple of years where my holdings halved at one point and then doubled, my holdings by the time I sold it, 20 cents, has continued to shoot up and become a potential six-bagger. Even though I knew with a billion shares on issue, they'd have to make a considerable amount of money to get to a decent valuation. And if they use the classic, we'll be millionaires if only get to X percent of the addressable market, which is regular and honest. Doc, what do you say to Adrian? So the story there is obviously one of, I probably made some money from Liquid, maybe not, but in any case, sold early, the stock then went on to greater heights. How do you get past the mindset of what ifs and regretful selling?
Adrian, I think again, the fact that something has gone up 6x doesn't necessarily mean that your selling was wrong. Mm-hmm. In the sense that if there was a reason behind why you sold it, and if you think the reason still holds,
right,
you're still correct in selling it. I don't know much about Avita Medical. I know a little bit. I did look at it recently because, you know, they were going about doing a roadshow, I believe, in the U.S. as well, and, you know, drumming up support there. And, you know, it is sometimes difficult to estimate what the value of the company would be given this very early stage business. So maybe you were right in the sense that you made a decision that, well, you know, look, maybe it looks fairly valued or overvalued enough that, you know, gotten ahead of itself and you wanted to sell out, assuming what, you know, it was part of your thesis. That said, every so often is going to make a mistake. There's going to, you know, you're going to not buy something that's going to go up. You're going to sell something that's going to then go up. Yeah. You're going to hold on to something that's going to go down. That's all part of investing, I think. And, you know, it's good to try to draw some lessons sometimes. Mm. Sometimes we can draw too many lessons out of them, which is not, I think, very useful. I think what matters is as long as you continue to hold a good collection of shares in a diversified portfolio and they continue to beat the market, then, you know, the rest, everything is a little bit of a sideshow. And I wouldn't worry too much about it.
Yeah, I can't add much more to that. Honestly, this is a really, really, really poor answer, except it's also the best one, which is you just kind of have to get used to it. That the reality is you are going to have many, many more disasters through your investing life that are worse than this one for 100 different reasons. That is the reality. Doc just finished talking about the fact that some of these stocks are going to lose money, some are going to make money. The worst thing you can strive for as an investor is 100% success rate, because that means you never invest. Mm-hmm. And some degree, this, and again, I talked about being a psychological process. Stock's going to eventually start hitting me for saying stuff like when I keep repeating myself. But at some, like, this is literally the psychology of investing, right? It is embracing the fact you know you're going to be wrong and you have to do it anyway. You almost have to make friends with the pain, if you like, you know, to use a horrible self-improvement phrase. It is going to happen. There's going to be more and more and more of this, right? So the best thing you can do is literally make your peace with it. It'll never stop it. You may not ever get over it. You just have to make your peace with it and you're just going to happen. Second to that, what I would say, and not about Avita at all, I don't know the company from Adam, and I'm not saying to anybody don't sell, but what I would say is my single biggest mistake at Motley Fool Share Advisor, the service that I run at The Fool, is selling out on a stock too early, same as what you've done. I could have lost 100% on six other stocks before I offset the money that I cost our members by selling a particular company. This was Domino's too early. I bought it at 6, sold it at 13. They went on to be 70 at some point, back to 45 odd at the moment. It is back on our scorecard, by the way, as a recommendation, but I didn't get to bank the money in between because I was too silly. there, you know, be careful about how many speculative stocks you own, but also be slow to sell. My greatest learning maybe over all this time is just being slower to sell. If you've done the work and you're buying for the right reasons, and I don't know whether you did, by the way. So again, this is absolutely not about Avita either then or now. If you've done enough work and you can confidently say, I bought for the right reasons, you're probably better off holding as many or more of those until you genuinely know the thesis is broken. I'm far, far more likely to sell these days on quality rather than valuation. And that's because if you've got a quality business and the underlying thesis of, I think this is a really well-run business, doing good things, doing their best with good favorable economics and all that kind of stuff, if the price is a bit too high, A, to Doc's point, it can keep going higher. B, if you've done well to pick the company in the first place, you're probably being run by a great management team, or at least a decent management team with decent brands or contracts or something going for the business in the first place. So I am far, far less likely to sell now based on quality reasons and on valuation reasons, far, far more likely to sell on quality reasons. You're probably better off overall holding rather than selling, even if you're a little bit uncomfortable about valuation. Doc?
I think that the last point, actually, you know, I'd be remiss to say that, you know, that's something that I actually missed, and I should have said that, yeah. Be slow to sell is actually probably a great thing to do.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Let's keep going, mate. A question from Mark. Because you get kicks out of Instagram questions, he says. How did he know?
You get kicks out of it. And everybody gets kicks that, you know, that this Zuck thing is still on. I mean, come on. Okay, fine.
Instagram for the win, mate. Because you get kicks out of Instagram questions, straight up, thank you for answering my question on your recommended reading lists. Understand the basis for your foolish goodness. It is always enjoyable listening to you both banter about a topic close to my heart. I have two questions. I love the second one, by the way. I'm looking forward to getting this one. Firstly, you keep preaching your hashtag get a better rate ideology. How do you weigh up the negative impact numerous mortgage transfers on your credit report, especially noting that positive reporting has not been fully embraced? I'll answer this one, Doc, because it's normally my better rate rant, so feel free to jump in as well. Look, at some point, changing credit providers too frequently can negatively impact your credit score, but far, far less impactful than you think. Far worse to have multiple credit products rather than multiple changes of bank or building society. That said, I don't advocate people change every 6 or 12 months, right? This is about finding the best rate you can. Generally speaking, by the way, if you find a great rate, there's every probability you're going to be a non-bank lender or non-major bank lender anyway, who culturally and frankly strategically wants to be a lower rate provider because that's how they get their business. So if you go from paying, you know, a higher rate at big bank number one, and you end up, as I am, with Sydney Credit Union, for example. Again, I have no commercial relationship other than a transaction account and a mortgage with them. Chances are they're going to keep their rates reasonably low relative to the competition because that's just their business model. And so you don't need to change regularly. That's probably the first thing. Second thing is, when I say get a better rate, I actually don't advocate people change if they can avoid it. You're far better off going to your bank saying, hey, I can get this better rate. What can you do to match it? And if they can match it, then you're even better off. If they get meaningfully close to it, you may still be better off staying and then changing less frequently. So yes, absolutely, mate. You're right to ask the question. I don't think people should change too regularly. That being said, there's a bit of money to be saved. But if you can make a one-off massive change, the people who can save the most, the ones who probably haven't negotiated a rate for 5 years, are probably paying something close to the standard variable rate and have 0.4, 0.5, 0.6% to save. Once you've saved that and got to a very competitive rate, the chance that you want to or need to change anytime in the next 12 or 18 months is pretty low. So I wouldn't let that put you off. I would change anyway. I mean, look, you know, I said if the third or fourth time you want to change to save 0.1%, you can't because your credit score, it's a pretty nice problem to have, right? If you're on the second lowest rate in the market. So I think the benefits far, far, far outweigh any cost when it comes to credit reporting. Doc, any thoughts?
No, I don't have any thoughts on that.
Next question is a really cool one. I like this one. We might have fun with this. I don't know your views on this. He says, what are your thoughts on an Australian sovereign wealth fund? Taking a cut of the taxes from fossil fuel consumption and mineral extraction for investment. Say you use 50% of gains to invest in renewable energy research, food production, protection, etc. And how would we balance this against the huge sums of money already invested in Australia by super funds? Sovereign wealth fund, mate, yes or no?
I love this question, actually. I think this is something actually Australia should do. Because some countries are, I mean, again, it depends on whether you can do it successfully or not. But a country like Norway, for example, has done really well with its sovereign wealth fund. And, you know, in a way, it's effectively saying that, you know, we are going to pave our future using our current resources, and you know, we're going to invest and grow, which is, you know, which can then in the future be used for paying various things or just reducing taxes or whatever else. Yeah, so I think this is a great idea. I like this.
Yeah, I thought you would. I'm a massive, massive, massive fan of it. I think we've missed. Look, unfortunately, we've missed the boat. And again, whenever we talk policy, there are positives and negatives, and there are political parties that were for and against stuff. So it is what it is. I'm absolutely not scared to put a policy point of view across, knowing that it's a policy view rather than a party political one. We wasted dramatically the mining boom of the 2007 through 2011 or so. It was passed on as tax cuts, and people can say, well, you know, we deserve the tax cuts and that kind of stuff, and that's a whole different issue for someone else. The reality was it was a one-off boom that was delivered to Australian taxpayers as a recurring tax cut, and that makes no sense. If your boss gives you, you know, a $1,000 bonus at the end of the year, buying a new car on the basis of getting $1,000 every single year is probably a gutsy and not very smart thing to do. That's kind of what we did with the mining boom that we wasted on passing on recurring tax cuts. Now, again, we can argue about how much government should tax and spend, and that's a whole different question. The reality was the money that was generated by that as a one-off was spent as a recurrence. I absolutely think we should put it in a sovereign wealth fund. Mark, I think it's a smart, smart, smart idea. I would go further. I think when you can borrow, government can borrow at 1-1.5%. This is a very, very controversial view, unconventional view. Frankly, we should be buying back national assets, in my view, not because they're national assets, not because of any xenophobic or nationalistic perspective on my behalf, simply because if you can find a business you can buy the shares of and buy them to borrow at 1%, the chance that your returns from that purchase are going to exceed 1% is almost 100% on average across the board. Now, individual companies, again, for what it's worth, if you said to me, I could borrow at 1% with no margin calls, I would buy as much of the ASX as you would let me. I'd buy as much of the US market as you would let me. And so that's a really, really easy one. So yes, I would absolutely do a sovereign wealth fund. I don't think we've got exactly so much surplus tax revenue at the moment that we can afford to fund it a lot is the problem. But I would frankly use borrowing and do it that way. Now, governments aren't great at investing, so we have to work out how it's done. But the super fund, the future fund is a pretty good starting point, right? We've found a way to invest on behalf of the government at arm's length from the government reasonably successfully. If you said to the future fund, here's another, I'm going to make a number up, $1 trillion that we've borrowed at 1%, knock yourselves out. All you got to give me back is 2% a year to pay the bills, and you can have the rest. It's an easy decision.
Yeah, I mean, you know, an interesting point might be to say that, you know, all super is actually going to the super fund.
Right, yes. Now, what I will say too, you asked about how is it balanced against the Australian, so I'll actually read it rather than summarising it. How would we balance this against the huge sums of money already invested in Australia by super funds? The answer is that, and Doc will absolutely back me up on this, Australian investors generally, let alone super funds, should be investing far, far, far more outside Australia than we currently are. Yeah, and that's an easy thing. Yeah, you're right. If we put all that money to work on the ASX, it would make the ASX uninvestable because share price would be so high as to be stupid. Australia is 2% of the world's capital markets. In other words, we could deploy 50 times as much money outside Australia as inside very easily. Now, whether we want that proportion to be the ongoing proportion is a different question, but it's unavoidable that we should be investing far more. Just because we happen to be born in Australia or raise taxes in Australia or be governed from Canberra doesn't mean that an investment in Woolworths is any smarter than an investment in Apple or Amazon or Berkshire, which Doc and I own various portions of each of those three. To say that we, you know, the Future Fund or any other fund should only, or frankly, Australian super funds should invest in Australia because this is where we are, I think is absolute madness.
Yeah, I think that's in a way, it's actually a brilliant way of securing your future, right? You basically use your current riches and use that to partake in other people's innovations. I mean, you know, that's really having, you know, your cake and eating it too.
Oh, and right. A previous podcast, we talked about China's buying Bellamy's because they have a longer-term perspective.
Yeah.
What can be longer-term in perspective than an Australian sovereign wealth fund that literally is investing for multiple, you know, my grandkids' grandkids?
Yeah, exactly. So if you're investing for Australia for 100 years plus, you know, go find
the 1%.
Yeah.
Drives me nuts.
To go buy the best businesses you can, whether they're ASX, NZX, or wherever else, private businesses, whatever it is.
Right.
Right. And absolutely. And, you know, I think the idea of even nationalizing or, you know, buying back or buying substantial shares in, national asset type of businesses makes absolute sense.
Madness. Mate, one last one quickly. We're almost finished. We've got one last question, so I figure I don't want to leave it as an orphan by itself. This one's from Mitch. Mitch is also rubbing it in. Thanks very much, Mitch. Hi, guys. First of all, what a great podcast for people wanting to gain the ultimate goal of financial freedom. Mitch, I'm just going to say that sounds like something you should write as a review on iTunes is all I'm saying.
I think so.
He says, I'm a 21-year-old finance student. Thanks for rubbing it in. And I'm currently thinking ultra long term. Good man. I recently had a chat with a friend who urged me to think of diversifying globally with a low-cost ETF to get exposure to the likes of Alphabet, Alibaba, and, of course, the doc's favorite, Apple. Other than that, I can see some merits in this approach, but with the dollar so weak, is it currently higher risk, and what part do exchange rates play when investing internationally? Would love to know your thoughts. Full on. As always, Mitch, love the sign-off. Mate, I'm going to throw this one straight to you. With the dollar at 68-ish cents, is now really the time to be buying an overseas ETF?
This is a brilliant question. I guess he hit it right. It's probably one of the biggest risks right now in terms of buying an international ETF or ETF that has international exposure with no hedging, or buying direct, especially in the US, because relative to the US dollar, our dollar is weak. Here's the thing, though. If you believe that the long-term average is, say, around 75 cents, right? Mm. And if that is the average, then you're not meaningfully, you're about 10% from there. If you're thinking long-term compounding and you can get enough outperformance, then 10% is roughly 1 year's return.
Right.
In that sense, it probably does not matter if your outlook is, five plus years, right? If your outlook is a decade, it probably does not matter. If your outlook is 3 years or less, then it probably does matter a lot because the exchange rate could be anywhere in that period. That said, of course, if you're buying at 68 cents and then by the time you're selling Australian dollars, is $1.30, that is going to take out a lot of your returns. So that is a meaningful risk that one needs to be aware of. But I think on balance, I think over a longish period, I think we should be still okay.
Yeah, I think that's right. I've been reluctant, as I've said to you, Doc, off air, to invest in large amounts in the US for that reason. I think ultra long term, as you rightly point out, Doc, the thing is that unless you have a, let me take a staff step back, the currency matters only as much as the two transactions you make to transfer money over to the US and then transfer money back from the US. Now, the chance the dollar isn't 68 cents at some future point, between now and hopefully when you need money, which given you're 21 is probably literally up to 60 years ago, here's time, you can time your exchange back anyway. So first, on the first instance, I think Doc's right. Over the long term, the compound value of it is going to dwarf any exchange rate changes. That's the first important thing. Second thing is, let's say you get to 58, right? Imagine being that old. Some of us are getting closer than you are, mate. But imagine you're 58. You're thinking, okay, well, I know I'm going to need the money sometime in the next 10 years. So I'm just going to take advantage. If and when the exchange rate gets lower than average, I might try and bring some of that money back. And you can absolutely decide when you want to return that money. So yes, at 68 cents, if the dollar goes to $1 US, you're going to say, oh, I've lost all this money. But like all short-term price volatility, if the dollar subsequently goes 65 cents, then you actually made some money on the currency. So yes, if you knew you had to cash out at some arbitrary time in the future and you couldn't know what the exchange rate was at that point, that might be a consideration. Otherwise, I would happily invest in the US markets, in US stocks, in a US ETF, a global ETF, and just simply let time do its thing. Then as and when you get to, as I said, in decades and decades time, redeem that cash, you simply choose a good time for when the price and the currency are, if not completely favorable, you're not going to pick it exactly, you're not going to know exactly how far it goes up or down, but you just do it at a time of your choosing when the exchange rate is favorable enough that you feel comfortable. How'd I go, Doc?
I think you went fantastic.
Mate, that is it for the first podcast of 2020. It doesn't feel like 2020, does it?
It doesn't, but this year went by pretty quick.
It did. Well, it's because it's not 2020. It's only 2019 as we record this. But, our future selves, mate, right now, with any luck, I'm sitting in front of the cricket. I'm pretty happy about that. I'm actually future Scott. I'm feeling very, very envious of future Scott, who's sitting in front of the first day of the New Year's test at the SCG. Anyway. Hopefully he's enjoying that. Hopefully you've enjoyed our podcast and hopefully the Aussies are winning on day one. And that wraps us up for the first podcast of 2020. Before you go, start the year off. Here's the thing. Have you got a New Year's resolution yet? You probably don't. Or maybe you do. Maybe it's one of those lose weight, stop smoking. You can't really keep those. You know what New Year's resolution you can keep? Leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. I think that's a resolution. You can tick that off your list. How good would it be to know that on the 4th of January, you've kept your New Year's resolution?
I think that's a pretty good resolution, don't you?
I love that idea. That's a great, you know, great. Go to iTunes, provide, you know, or go to the podcast app on iTunes and provide a beautiful review.
Leave a review, leave some stars, just, you know.
5 stars.
And feel good, exactly. And feel good about yourself because you've kept a resolution. So there you go. New Year's resolution for everybody. For the rest of this year, you can say, when someone says, oh, how are you going with the resolution? You say, nailed it. Already done it. Job done. If that is not the way to start 2020, I don't know what is. So do that for us, please. And don't forget, you can get a dose of foolishness straight to your inbox by going to fool.com.au/MMM. Triple M. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.